Mr. K Super Show, a podcast for the discerning music and pop culture geek, hosted by Chris Karam. Welcome to Mr. K Super Show. I'm Chris Karam, aka Chris Karam, and today we have a very special guest. This woman is a pioneering women in rock DJ, and she was very instrumental, no pun intended, in the ascent of the band Rush, who we all know and love. Donna Halper, welcome to the show.
What a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. Let's just get straight to the point. You, congratulations, by the way, on your forthcoming induction to the Massachusetts Broadcasters Hall of Fame. That's incredible.
Yeah, I was totally shocked when I got the call. I could not believe it. I'm getting the Pioneer Broadcaster Award, and I am the first woman to ever receive it. It's just such a privilege. It's just a validation of my life's work, and I'm very, very grateful to the Mass Broadcasters. And for those that are in the neighborhood, the luncheon is June 8th. You can get tickets on the website. It would be just a privilege to see everybody. It's Mass Broadcasters Hall of Fame. I think they're a .org, but a simple Google search will turn them up. But yeah, what a privilege.
Yes, and well-deserved. You know, you were there during the great golden age of FM, as far as I'm concerned, because the 70s, the 60s, that was when FM really was a force and a force to be reckoned with, from my perspective.
Well, radio was certainly different back then, okay? People have asked me often on podcasts, webcasts, and every place else that I go, could you discover Rush today? And the answer is no, I don't think I could. Not because I'm a horrible person, although my enemies would say that I am, but because radio is so different today. It's much more corporate. It's much more playlist. There are fewer live and local stations. We had so much freedom at WMMS in Cleveland. Okay. It wasn't perfect. I would be lying if I said, oh, yes, it was a perfect radio station. But no, it was just a different time. And in that time, many more stations were taking chances on new music. Not even like new music from record labels, but sometimes unsigned bands. People forget when Bob Roper of A&M of Canada sent me the Rush album, which I still have. Okay, I wouldn't part with it for $1 million. But when Bob Roper sent me that record, in an act of altruism, his label was not going to sign them. And he could have just tossed it in the garbage at that point. But he sent it to me because he believed in the band. He'd seen them play. And when I listened to Working Man, I believed in the band too. But my point is, they weren't signed. They were like a product of Moon Records, which was sort of a loving hands at home out of Toronto. And they weren't on, you know, Columbia or RCA or Mercury or any of them. No. So I still had the freedom to play them. And we did that back then, not just with Rush, but with a number of bands that like had a demo. We thought they had potential. If they were local, we had them come in and do a coffee break concert live, this sort of thing. And we could get behind a band. Today, that is much less likely. There are fewer stations that could do what WMMS was doing. And by the end of the decade, and the reason that the song Spirit of Radio got written, by the end of the decade, so many stations had become much more corporate, had become much more restrictive, were playing fewer new songs. And even Neil noticed it. The guys in the band noticed it. It all became about the words of the prophets, P-R-O-F-I-T-S.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And agreed. Everybody likes to make a living. Everybody likes to make a few bucks. But on the other hand, do you really want to sell your soul to make a few bucks? And a lot of stations, I think, kind of sold their souls. They lost that unique creative aspect and went for just mass appeal at all costs. Now, again, nothing wrong with a little mass appeal. There's plenty of hits and I love them. But on the other hand, Rush didn't have a hit. They were a brand new band. So in order to play them, I had to be willing to take a chance. I was willing to take a chance. I did take a chance, and it worked out very well. But in the case of a lot of other bands that we took a chance on, nothing. It just didn't resonate with the audience. I'm still glad I did it. I'm still glad I took that chance. It was fun being a music director. But you never knew how things were going to turn out. There was no guarantee. It wasn't like, aha, Donna played Working Man and the rest is history. There was no guarantee. I played Working Man because I thought it would resonate with a Cleveland audience. It did. But I can tell you a multitude of other albums that we played that we thought were great songs. And the audience was like, yeah, whatever. So it was a different world. It was a different time. There was a sense of creativity and adventurousness. I'm glad that I was able to participate in it. But as I said, there were no guarantees. And I am profoundly grateful that Bob Roper sent me that record. I'm profoundly grateful that I had the freedom to put it on the air. And I'm also profoundly grateful that I had the opportunity to become friends with the band. People always say to me, when they did get a record deal with Mercury Records, did you get a finder's fee? I'm like, no, I got a 48-year friendship with the band. I got nothing to complain about, seriously. And I am very grateful that I have that 48-year friendship. When I got the news that I was being inducted into the Massachusetts Broadcasters Hall of Fame, I was able to send an email to Alex.
Nice.
I was able to send an email to Getty's sister. She passed it on to Getty because Getty's traveling. I mean, if you had told me in 1974 that I would still be in touch with the band, I know Neil's parents, God rest his father's soul, but I'm saying when they lived, I was able to, you know, when his father lived, I was able to keep in touch. I was able to keep in touch with his really good friend, Craig. I was able to keep in touch with that whole circle of people that Rush were loyal to right from the beginning because they had been there from the beginning. The people that worked for their label, the people that helped them get a contract, et cetera, et cetera. I was part of all that. They could have forgotten me the moment they got what they wanted. But they never did because that's not the kind of people they are.
That's an awesome story, and that's really great. You know, if you listen to classic rock, which I don't anymore, because like every other segment of terrestrial radio, as they call it these days, it's just narrow listed to death. You would think Rush released 5 songs, and Tom Sawyer, Limelight, The Spirit of Radio, Working Man, maybe Subdivisions. And that's true of every classic rock band.
I've heard Closer to the Heart.
Okay, Closer to the Heart. But still, you would think that Rush only released 5 or 6 songs in their lifetime. And that,
you mean they didn't? You mean they didn't? They did more songs?
I think they have a much wider range of albums, something like upwards of 20-plus studio albums.
You think? See, I was on this thing called the Rush Deep Dive. You can find them on YouTube. And we did like a whole bunch of Rush deep dives where we went into each album and talked about some songs that had been overlooked. Oh, yeah, they've got a massive catalog of songs. And it's a shame that mass appeal radio felt like you said, that the only songs they could play were the ones that were like the hits. Yeah. And there's a lot more than that.
Oh, yeah. And I wanted to relate a story that I'm not sure you're aware of. Now, you, of course, know of the Casablanca Records label from the 70s.
Of course.
And the late Neil Bogart.
Neil Bogart, God rest his soul, died way too young.
Yep. Well, Larry Harris, who was his cousin and ended up being VP of the label during its heyday.
Oh, my God, Larry. I remember Larry.
He basically related in his book that he went to go see Rush at a club in Canada, ultimately deciding not to sign them, thinking they didn't have the right look or that their sound wasn't really commercial. But he did say that if the company had been in better shape, because this was the first year of the company's operation, the company had been in better shape financially, he would have taken a flyer on them. He went to Neil Bogart and said, I don't think they've got it. And but you have to decide for yourself, Neil. And Neil Bogart said, no, if you don't want to sign them, I trust your judgment. And Larry Harris says, to Neil Bogart's credit, he never rubbed it in his face, because as he put it in the last chapter, I mean, the last paragraph of that chapter, the wrongness of my decision became more and more apparent with each passing year. Yep. I shudder to say this, but the band I didn't sign, because he never referenced them by name, is Rush. And it's like, but you know, if they had ended up in Casablanca, I do not think they would have had the career that they did, because Casablanca would not have been the right label for them.
I understand. Well, when they signed with Mercury, their record promotion, their national record promotion guy, Cliff Bernstein, friend of mine, promised me that they would make Rush a priority. They had Bachman Turner Overdrive, and they said, we will make Rush a priority. They were a smaller label. They weren't really known for rock and roll. I was afraid that if they signed with one of the bigger labels who were also sniffing around, that they'd just get lost in the shuffle, that they would be like, you know, the 19th band to be promoted. And I believed Cliff, because Cliff was a gentleman. You saw him in Beyond the Lighted Stage. He really made that band a priority. He liked that band, and he really stood up for Rush, and I appreciated it.
I want to get back to Rush, but I want to backtrack a little and kind of go back in time to when you started out as a female DJ, because obviously...
I've always been female, so, you know, I had no choice in that matter.
True, but let's face it, it was, up to that point, largely a male-dominated industry.
Absolutely, sure was.
So what got you to that point where you became a DJ, and what particular challenges did you face being a quote-unquote female DJ in a, you know, male-dominated industry, which it still was in the 70s or thereabouts?
Well, once upon a pond in a kingdom far away, I was growing up in Dorchester, Massachusetts, which is a neighborhood of Boston. And then we moved to Roslindale, which is another neighborhood of Boston. Now, I know what you're thinking. So what, Donna? Well, actually, very large so what. Dorchester was just about all Jewish back then. Roslindale, we were the only Jews in the neighborhood. Okay, and anti-Semitism was still around. The other thing that was still around was rampant sexism. It was like girls could be teachers, nurses, secretaries, receptionists. That was it. When I turned on my radio, because I loved rock and roll from the time I was a kid, when I turned on my radio, all I ever heard was guys. And not that there was anything wrong with that, but I always wondered, like, where are women at? You know? And it, like, the women were doing cooking shows or like fashion, but I wasn't interested in those things. I loved baseball from the time I was a kid. And I'm like, I want to be a sports reporter, you know, or I want to be a DJ and play the hits. Except I was told if I wanted to be a DJ, I had to have a big, deep voice. And I didn't have a big, deep voice. But on Boston radio, I mean, I think I have a pretty good voice for a female person. I think it's pretty mid-range, but even if I did have a big, deep voice, you know, it would have been unusual. Long story short, though, in Boston, the number one DJ when I was growing up was a guy named Arnie Ginsberg, and he talked like this, and I'm not making it up. Arnie was an accidental DJ. He didn't plan on it. It just happened one night. They needed somebody on the air. He was working late. There he was. You know, he was an engineer. And he got on the air, and he was like every man. Everybody loved Arnie. He just sounded so relatable. And he would make fun of his own voice. He called himself aching adenoids, old leather lungs, you know. But long story short, he became exceedingly popular in Boston. And he didn't have a big, deep voice. He played the hits. He was having fun. And I said to myself, if Arnie can do it, I can do it. One of the happiest moments of my life was in 2004 when I finally got to meet the guy, you know, and I got to bow before him and I got to make him a promise. And I promised that if I ever wrote a book about Boston radio, I'd put him on the cover. And I did. And I was told a couple of years ago. Now, he unfortunately, at the end of his life, had Alzheimer's, from what I was told, and didn't remember a whole lot about his life or his career or anything. But his spouse told me, Donna, that book, he would carry it with him. And he would, like, even when he didn't remember stuff, he would look at the cover of that book. And it was like there was recognition there for him. He knew that was probably him. And that meant a lot to me, okay? And I really cannot overstate how much of an impact it had on me, having a DJ in the market who kept his name. He was Arnie Ginsberg. You didn't like it. He was not going to be John Smith or Jack Jones. He was Arnie Ginsberg. He was himself. And that really said something to me. So I knew from the time I was a kid that I wanted to either be a sportscaster or a rock and roll DJ. When I went up to Northeastern, and I've told this story many times, and it's still true. When I went up to Northeastern to the campus radio station, and I applied to be on the air, and they told me I couldn't be on the air because I was a girl. And I'm like, what's that got to do with anything? And they said, well, we don't have girls on the air. I said, why not? He said, they don't sound good. I said, how many of you had on the air? And they said, none, they don't sound good.
Awesome.
Which struck me as a catch 22. And it led me to embark upon a 4-year battle, at the end of which, in October of 1968, I became the first female DJ in the history of Northeastern University. And somehow the Republic did not fall. And that's where my career started. That's where I first was a music director. That's where I first was a DJ. And that's where I first started following my dream, not knowing that an awful lot of people in the industry still didn't hire women. And it took me like 3 more, 4 more years after I graduated before I finally found a station that would give me a chance, a little daytime station called WCAS in Cambridge. I miss it to this day. And I was teaching in the Boston Public Schools in the morning and being on the air at WCAS in the afternoon. And that led me out to Cleveland and Washington, D.C. and New York and a whole host of other places. And to a 40-year career, I met some amazing people. I broke some songs. I trained some DJs. Had a lot of fun. But I got to tell you, I never got equal pay. I did get sexually harassed. I was in that generation just a little bit too soon, the generation where a lot of the guys didn't want us there. The women that did get on the air, in some cases, yeah, they were not real welcomed. I sure wasn't. Now, I had a complication in the fact that I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't do drugs. I got in it for the music, not for the lifestyle. And there were people that kind of put me down and mocked me because I didn't do some of that stuff. I didn't party with them. But I did play, I think, a lot of great songs. And I did break a lot of great bands. And I did have a really interesting and exciting career. And I can't complain about any of it.
Well, you know, somebody's going to make that first step, you know, and by you know, and so, like by the end of the 70s, I do remember there was a very famous, I think she was syndicated, Alison Steele.
Oh, sure. She was on WNEW-FM in New York. Died very young of cancer. What a shame. Yeah.
And I would listen to her stuff, and I'm like, and as a young man, I didn't hear it when she was first doing it because I don't know where she was based out of. But, you know, later on, I saw videotapes and I heard stuff, and I'm like, man, if I'd heard that voice, I would have been tuned in all the time because she just had that really warm.
Well, she started out with a guy that was her husband at the time. His name was Ted Steele, and their act was Ted and the Redhead. Okay. Oh, and they got divorced, but she stayed on the air, and she was a big hit on WNEW-FM as the Nightbird. You were supposed to have this sexy voice, and she certainly did. Yeah. Really legendary announcer. But yeah, a lot of the early women in broadcasting did not find a warm welcome, a hearty handshake, and a laurel wreath. What they found was, we don't want you here, okay? And in some cases, they wouldn't hire us. In other cases, they did, but they just made it real plain that they didn't like us. But as time went on, people started being more accepting. And I'm glad I was one of the people who opened the door so that other women and minorities could walk, because they wouldn't hire in minorities either. But I'm glad that that door did get open. I'm glad for my very small part in it. And I feel very humbled that I'm still here, still standing, still alive, and still able to tell some of these stories.
And there's stories that need to be told because, I mean, fans like me and my cousin Joe, who was like an Uber Rush fan to the nth degree, you know, we know all this stuff because we've seen the documentary, we've read the books, we know the history.
But I lived it. I didn't just read the books.
I think it's important that people know that because no band gets to the top just because they make great music. There's people pulling for them in the media,
absolutely,
at the record label. And Rush, you know, let's face it. You know, they were these guys from Canada who had, you know, had a really great first album. But had you not taken that chance, and I want to kind of go where were you exactly when you came across the Rush album? What you were in, was it Philadelphia?
Or? Sitting in my office. I was the music director at WMMS, and I was listening to new music.
Yep.
And I got this thing in a manila envelope, which didn't look like the way things are usually sent to us. We're usually sent stuff in these fancy schmancy envelopes with the record company name on it and this and that. And this was like, oh, it's my friend Bob Roper. Yeah, he sends me stuff now and then because he knows we play imports. And we play Canadian bands, we play British bands before they're released in the United States. I mean, you know, imports are a big deal back in those days. It was very exciting to get some of them. So like, yeah, you know, wonder what Roper is sending me. But it was all part of just being a music director. And when we started playing that record and started getting good response to it, I got on the phone and I was calling up other radio stations and kind of promoting the band, you know what I mean? It was like, why not? I mean, it's doing well for us. I'd like to see it do well for some other people too. And I did that on several of their early records. I knew when they told me, when Neil joined the band, because John Rutsey had very, very bad diabetes. He wasn't taking care of himself, God rest his soul. He was a kid. These folks were 20 and 21 years old when a lot of this is happening, okay? A lot of folks got turned on to Rush years later. It was very interesting being a big sister to the band at the beginning. I mean, Alex still jokes around with me about that I'm their big sister. You know, they don't need a big sister now. They're fine. But at the time, yeah, I was kind of the big sister. And I would call other, you know, radio stations and I would like try to get them more attention and talk to the trade magazines and this and that because I liked them. I believed in them. And when they told me about Fly By Night and that they had much of it like recorded, and then they did that gig at the Agora Ballroom where they did a shout out to me and thanked me for, you know, playing Working Man. And but this is how they were. They never forgot the people that helped them. Years later, they never forgot me. They could have. They never did. And I kept working on their behalf. I was part of a committee that fought to get them a star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame, me and about four other people. We worked real hard on that. And, you know, it was great when they called and asked if I wanted to, like, deliver the speech that gave them their star. They didn't have to do that. Okay, there were plenty of famous people they could have picked. They did pick Billy Corgan. He and I both co-presented, which was kind of fun. So long story short, these are guys where what you see is what you get. They are down to earth. They are honest. They are compassionate. Now, are they perfect? No, of course not. Nobody is. Everybody has a bad day. But I'm saying overall, they were very down to earth. And success never spoiled them.
When you met Rush back in 1974, what were your first impressions of the guys, Geddy, Alex, and the original drummer, John Rutsey? And we'll start with Geddy.
Well, I'll be very honest with you because I like to retroactively look back and go, oh, yes, I knew immediately, but I didn't. I met artists all the time. And I wasn't taking notes. That's going to sound horrible because, like, years later, it's like, oh my God, you met Rush. But I met lots of bands. I was a music director, and I did not know at the time that meeting Rush would lead to a 45-year or 47-year or 90-year relationship. Nobody knows those things. So at the time, I was like, oh, they're very shy. They're very polite. They're cute. And I mean cute in a good way. I mean, as in, oh, kind of like your younger brother sort of thing. In fact, that was the standing joke that I was the band's big sister. Okay. And it's true. All of them, all three of them, just seemed really shy. They had never really been out of Toronto before. I mean, yes, of course, they'd been over the border. It's not like they had never traveled. But I'm saying they were three kids from Toronto who never really thought that they would be in Cleveland with people shouting out after them, having seen their pictures on that album. And I mean, Getty was surprised. I do have a Getty story. Getty was surprised that people recognized him. Now, again, I'm not going to lie to you and go, oh, thousands of people lined the streets, because nah, they were still pretty unknown. They were one of a number of new bands that we were playing. And the fact that anyone took notice of them was a big deal because, as Getty said to me, we can't get arrested in Toronto. Nobody will play our songs. It's like Toronto is going through this, I'm paraphrasing, mellow jello period of time. It's like all they want to play is Barry Manilow, whatever the equivalent of that sort of thing is on album rock, like just ballads, like soft rock. And we can't get any hard rock songs played on the radio. So we're just playing in the clubs. And they never expected that their songs would somehow make their way to Cleveland. So, yeah, my only impression was not of individuals. My only impression was that as a band, they seemed really shy. And I really wanted them to feel welcome and I wanted them to feel at home.
Well, that's great. I mean, obviously, being from Canada and being kind of basically respectful people, from what I can see, they seem to be pretty decent guys.
Absolutely. And they always have been. That's a fact. That's not an act.
I've never heard anything remotely scandalous about any of
No,
those guys. I
and you
mean,
won't. And you won't. Nope.
now, obviously, John Rutsey was the original drummer, but he had some health issues, as we discussed earlier, diabetes, and he wasn't taking care of himself. And also, from what I understand, Getty and Alex wanted to expand the sound a bit, do longer pieces, more involved things. And I think John Rutsey might have been more of a sort of four on the floor, more of a straightforward type drummer. So John Rutsey leaves, and of course, they bring in another kid, an even younger kid who would be later known as the professor. Of course, I'm talking about the late, great Neil Peart here.
And the new guy.
The new
Till
guy.
the day the band broke up, he was always the new guy.
Yeah, and I mean, here he comes and he's a skinny kid. He's this drum wunderkind. I mean, he can play like nobody's business. He's got a bit of a Keith Moon influence, but an intellect, obviously a very sharp intellect, and he was able to bring, lyrics and concepts to Rush that they probably wouldn't have had with John Rutsey. And I'm not saying that's not John Rutsey. He was just, like I said, more of a four on the floor, straight ahead drummer. Getty and Alex had much broader ambitions, obviously, and Neil was the perfect, kind of conduit.
I've always wondered, I'll be very honest with you again, because I keep saying I'll be very honest with you, but I mean that sincerely. There are a lot of stories about the band that, in many regards, are just like online rumors and they're demonstrably false. Like, for example, oh, yeah, Rutsey had a big falling out with the guys in the.
Yeah.
No, he didn't. He did not. There was no big falling out. What there was, for real, he was having trouble managing his diabetes, which was very hard to do in those days. And as a songwriter, he was very basic. He was not a bad songwriter. Okay. I mean, Working Man is a pretty good song.
Yes.
And the guys collaborated on it. And God bless them. It was a really good song. Okay. It has been misquoted over the years about what a bathroom song is. I did not have to go to the bathroom. Nobody had to go to the bathroom. But if anyone ever did, music directors always looked for long songs
Sure.
that the DJs could play.
Sure.
But as I have said a million times, they had to be good songs or we wouldn't play them. And Working Man was a good song. And if I'm
Yeah,
John
it was.
Rutsey looking
Yeah.
down from heaven, you know what? He should be very proud of himself because that was a really good rock and roll song. And it resonated with the audience. God bless him. May his soul rest in
Right.
peace. However, the band always had a vision for the next thing. They were limited by Rutsey's health. But even if they weren't limited by Rutsey's health, there absolutely were some creative differences. They liked each other. They were friends. There was, as I said before, no falling out, no giant arguments. But what there was a real difference in what the next thing was going to be for the band. So they always wanted to find someone who could really be a songwriter and really take them to the next level. Now, did they know they needed Neil? No, but they knew that they needed someone like Neil, someone who could, in fact, take them to that next level, whatever it looked like. And when Neil came along, he really did what they were hoping that he would do, because Getty did not have any confidence in himself as a songwriter back then. Now, personally, I think Madrigal is a lovely song. I think a couple of other songs that he had a hand in, I think Tears, just lovely songs. But that's not his main experience, his main expertise. He feels like, hey, I'm a bass player, okay? I can collaborate with people. But as a songwriter, and this whole thing about Neil as an intellect, I mean, let's be honest. Did Neil graduate from high school? Not as far as I know, but he was a reader. He was a thinker. He looked at literature. He looked at poetry. He looked at art. I mean, he had the kind of sensibility that the guys were looking for. And one more time, this is not to say Rutsey was a dummy. Rutsey was a very sharp guy and he was their friend. But if you're going to go to the next level, if you're going to take a band in a different direction, you need someone that can do that. And very often, just like in sports, sometimes you need a new manager. Sometimes you need a new coach. You know, sometimes you need to change quarterbacks or whatever. And it was kind of like that. So Neil fit in a way that was very different. He brought a different skill set. And seriously, my recollection of Neil is that he too was shy. And also, he was not real friendly towards me at first. Not because he hated me. He didn't. He didn't know me. And that's Neil. If he doesn't know you, he's very, some people have mistaken him for like, well, he's standoffish. No, he's just shy. And
Right.
once we sat down, he came over to my house. And once we sat down, my house, my apartment, I lived in Warrensville Heights. He came over to my apartment. And once we had an evening just kibitzing and talking poetry and talking music and talking everything about the industry, we became friends. Now, were we ever like best buds? No. I talk to Alex to this day much more than I ever talked to Neil. But the times that I did spend with Neil and the times that I did talk to him, they were very different from the typical conversation you expect from a rock musician. In fact, it kind of reminds me of conversations I had with Springsteen. I'm not trying to name drop. I'm just saying, like, as a music director, you hang out with musicians. And most of them, it's just kind of, you know, where's the bar? Where's, you know, where's the weed? This and that.
Right.
Springsteen was never like that. The guys in Rush were never like that. I'm not saying they never did weed. I'm not saying they never had a beer. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying they had a lot more on their mind than just
Yeah.
the typical rock star pursuits. They were family men. They cared deeply about their families. But my point is, you could talk poetry with Neil. There are not a whole lot of rock stars in my life that I've talked poetry with. You could talk philosophy with Neil. There aren't a lot of people I could talk philosophy with. I mean, come on, I got two master's degrees at that time. I don't have my doctorate yet, but I do have a pretty good education. And it's kind of nice to sit around and talk about those sorts of things. So, yeah, we had some really good conversations, but they weren't your typical conversations. And that's the very long answer to your question. So, my earliest recollections, the guys were incredibly shy. My later recollections, the guys are still incredibly shy, but they're becoming more confident, more comfortable in their own skin, more able to feel like, ah, yeah, we're ready for the next level and we can do this. And I was so happy that I was able to help them in any way in those years.
Right. I mean, obviously the building blocks for the Rush sound were there on that first album with, Finding My Way and Working Man, which, another, classic rock staple for years that got, that's
And
still played.
Here Again is a great song. I don't care what
Here Again,
anybody
right? Yep.
says.
But when you compare it to what, you listen to it, and then even Fly By Night, which is like, wow, this is like a bit of a quantum leap in terms of, a change, but yet there's
But I always look
continuity.
at it like, how old are you? How old are you? Okay, I'm
56.
76. How old are you?
56.
Okay. Were you born knowing how to walk, talk, and read?
Oh,
Didn't
hell
think
no.
so. Did
No,
not think so.
it took me a
Neither
while.
was I. I was born basically crying and hoping that somebody would feed me.
Yeah,
The
probably the
fact
same with
is,
me.
yeah, but that's my point. The fact is, all of us needed a place to start. All of us needed a foundation. All of us needed to be able to try to get on our feet and then fall down and go boom and then get back up again. The idea of comparing the first Rush album to what came later, I don't think it's useful. Because I look at it like Neil was the next thing, but none of it would have happened without the foundation
Right.
that
That's what, yeah.
Working Man and that first album set. Because if I didn't see the flashes of brilliance, I wouldn't have played the record. If they just sounded like your typical three chord bar band, I would have been like, yeah, Roper, thank you for sending me this record, but I'm with you. I don't think so. Okay. But I heard something. He heard something. We heard that these guys were going to go to the next level. We didn't know how, neither of us had a crystal ball, but we knew that this was not all there was, that Working Man was not all there was, that they weren't going to spend their lives doing 50 different versions of Working Man. Freebird, they weren't going to be known for just one song. And I'm not saying for all you Lynyrd Skynyrd fans that that's all they have is Freebird. But if I say Lynyrd Skynyrd, most people say Freebird. Let's be honest, okay? The fact is, though, when it comes to Rush, yeah, I could name you about 50 songs that when you say Rush, there are fans out there that are raising their hands. Little exercise, all you listeners. What's one song that comes to mind when I say Rush? I can hear you. You're all giving me different songs, and that's exactly my point.
And it's like we said, you have to start somewhere. That got them started. You helped set them on the path by getting that record on the radio.
And I
And then,
continued. I continued. I called radio stations and asked them to play the band, places I didn't even work for. Years later, like I said, I worked on getting them a star on the Walk of Fame along with a couple of other fans. Years later, I mean, I would call critics. When critics would trash them, they would hear from Auntie Donna, okay? And we would have a little conversation and I would
Good for
tell them
you.
about themselves. I advocated for years to get them into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, et cetera, et cetera. Did a lot of stuff behind the scenes, and that's fine. Never expected to get credit for it, never wanted to get credit for it. I'm just glad it all worked out, and the guys knew, and that's what matters.
Right. And obviously, like you said, there's no way you could have predicted that they would have had this 40 plus year career as a result of all this, but it happened. I think we're all better for it as listeners. I know, I was just posting in a thread today on Facebook about how my cousin and I were both taking guitar lessons from the same teacher back in 1981. Well, one day he hands us both a cassette with moving pictures on one side. Well, that kind of changed things up a little, you know? I didn't stick with guitar playing. My cousin did. I became a fan. My cousin became uber fan. He's seen them close to 30 times. I've seen them 7 or 8.
You
But
know what's
regardless.
gratifying? You know what's really gratifying, Chris? When I first met the guys, as we just said, polite but shy. Years later, they're millionaires. They got nice houses. They travel. They do this and that. And you know what? They're still the same nice, down-to-earth
Yeah.
human beings they always were. That is so unusual. I mean, if you saw Beyond the Lighted Stage, they're
Oh,
sitting
yes.
in Tim Hortons having donuts, and just success hasn't
Right.
spoiled. Success never spoiled them. They have been on some of the most famous stages with some of the most famous players, and they're still the same down-to-earth human beings they always were. Okay. And yes, Geddy really was good to his mother. Okay. I mean, I just want to put that out there
Yeah.
because you see all of these, oh, but he was so good to his mother. It's like, yeah, right. But no, Geddy was. Geddy was, these guys, these are family men. Now, as I said before, did they ever have a bad day? Sure. Did they ever not sign an autograph or maybe be a little bit grumpy? Absolutely. They're human beings. But overall, I have never in all my years of being in the media met three more down-to-earth human beings, and it extends to their whole organization. I'm still in touch with their management, for heaven's sake. Okay? There's nothing we can do for each other anymore. Okay? They're not outperforming, they're not on a regular label, but I'm still in touch because that's the kind of people they are. When they found out that I was being inducted into the Mass Broadcasters Hall of Fame, several of the members of the management reached out to me for no reason other than to just say congratulations. Okay? These are the kinds of people they are. And that's why, for years, members of the road crew, their kids became members of the road crew, their families became, it was like this family enterprise. Everyone got along. Everyone helped each other. I can honestly say I've never seen anything even remotely similar. These are just nice people.
Yes, and we're going to get even more insight this fall when Getty's autobiography comes out, which has been the title has been announced, which my cousin and I are both kind of surprised at the title.
A lot of people don't like the title. I've had like six or seven people email me like, I hate the title.
It doesn't seem like Getty. I mean, maybe we're going to find out some stuff that's a little different, maybe a little.
And it could be a tease for all we know. I've known plenty of publishing companies that will give you like a teaser title to get people talking. And same thing with TV shows. Oh, the name of the show is going to be Wiebelfetzer. And everybody goes, Wiebelfetzer? What's
Oh,
Wiebelfetzer?
Wiebelfetzer was great. I love
Oh,
the first
yeah. But
season.
you know what I'm saying? I mean, then
Yeah, I do.
everybody's online just howling
Oh,
about
of course,
how
of
can they
course.
call it Wiebelfetzer and this. And it turns out that's not what they were going to call it at all. So who knows?
Well, plus with their sense of humor, I mean, obviously they have a very tongue-in-cheek sense of humor,
Yeah. But you know
which
what? If that's what Getty wants to call the book, what do I care? I don't care if he calls it prunes, all right? As long as it makes him happy. Now, frankly, I hope he doesn't call it prunes, but if that's what he calls it, I mean, I was going around and around with a couple of people about that. We're going to write to him and tell him that. Please
Oh,
don't.
please let
Please
him.
don't.
Yeah, Getty will do what Geddy Lee wants to, and he should because of
Getty's
his.
a big boy now. He's over
Yes.
21. He can read and he can write.
Yeah,
And,
and I'm very eager to read that book and, get his insights and, his side of what
I'll be
happened.
honest with you, because here again, I mean, I'm not going to lie. I won't lie to you. I won't lie to anybody that interviews me. I've had some albums of Rush's that I wish they hadn't named it that. I've had some album covers that I liked better than
All
others.
right.
So what?
Can you name one of those records that you
I
didn't like
could, but
the
I
title?
won't.
Okay. That's
Because,
fair.
no, I'm
That's
very
fair.
serious because
That's fair.
these are my friends
Okay.
and I've never judged and evaluated their work. There have been albums, and I've been very public about this. There have been albums of theirs that I didn't like as much as other albums. And that's going to be like, it's going to my grave because it's nobody's business.
It's
totally subjective. Everybody likes what they like. And there are some people that like, you have a favorite album. These are my friends. Let them be happy. Let them create what they create. Let a thousand flowers bloom. If I don't like the first one, I'll like the next one. It's no problem. I can all, even on records I don't like as much. Like, I've been pretty public about the fact that Caress of Steel isn't one of my favorite records. But even on Caress of Steel is a couple of songs I love.
It's
so
still
it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Whatever makes you happy about their music, it's all still Rush, and they have such a large body of work that if one record ain't your favorite, the next one might be.
Well, you know, I've always felt that even though there's been changes in production, maybe some stylistic changes from album to album as the decades wear on, Rush is probably one of the most musically consistent bands ever to span like decades. You know, the Stones have had their ups and downs. Aerosmith
and
has had
one
ups
of
and
the
downs.
most creative. If you've ever seen them live, and I know you
Oh, I
have.
have. Oh, I have.
Have you ever seen them mail it in? I
oh,
never.
Oh, hell no, no.
Never.
I mean,
they played their butts off for 3 hours. I mean, no opening act, nothing. Just
no,
boom.
Total commitment to stagecraft, songcraft, and playing their asses, which they did every time I saw them. I never walked away from a Rush show thinking, well, maybe they need to, you know, retire, or maybe they should just kind of call it quits. No, if anything, I didn't see the final tour, unfortunately, but I did see it on DVD later. And they went out with class and with style. And I always
and
said
that Neil did say that. We were talking, and Neil said he never, and I'm paraphrasing here, he said he never wanted to go out as a parody of himself. He said, like, there are some artists that it's like they shouldn't be performing, okay? It's like their time came, their time went, time to retire, okay? They can't hit the notes anymore. They can't play the instruments. It's like he said, they're like parodies of themselves.
Yep,
He said, we
absolutely.
don't ever want to be that way. Okay, when the time comes that we can't do it at that level, we'll say goodbye. But we want to go out as our best. See, that's why I knew when Neil announced that they were going to retire, I knew he was serious. He was in a lot of pain because of his tendonitis, did not know about the cancer. I don't know if he knew about it at that point in time, but I sure knew about the tendonitis. And I knew that he was in so much pain every time he drummed that I was amazed he was still going out there at all.
I
Okay.
believe Alex was suffering from some tendonitis too, or
Yes,
some
he was.
similar. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well,
And I mean, come on, they weren't getting any younger. And they put
when you
a
play,
lot of energy and a lot of just boom into everything they do.
This isn't 4/4 time signature stuff. This is
oh, yeah.
complex,
This ain't the
progressive,
Waltz.
You know.
This
Oh,
ain't the Waltz.
Yeah. They went out on top. They had a hell of a career, and you played a very pivotal role in that. You know, had, you know, like in science fiction or in comic books, there's always that thing. If you alter one event on the timeline, everything gets changed. And if you hadn't done what you did, we might not be even talking today.
And if it hadn't worked out, because as I said before, just because I, as a music director, make a song, champion a song, play a song, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to resonate with the audience.
Oh, right.
There have been a multitude of songs that I thought were just like the best song ever. And I played it, and I got behind it, and I had the DJs play it, and we all got behind it, and crickets. Just nothing. The audience was just like, yep, is this going to be over anytime soon? And then there have been other songs that I sat there and I cringed every time I had to play it because I hated the song so much. And yet I knew the public liked it. I knew they were going to like it. And it was like fine with me. In Rush's case, it was a win-win because it was a song I believed in. It was a song I liked. And it was a song that the audience liked too. So there you are. But yeah, I spent years being kind of a big sister until they didn't need a big sister anymore. And then I became just like a friend and a cheerleader. And it hilarious story, though. I may have told it before. I'm at the Hollywood, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. And I'm backstage and Getty's mom is there. And she calls Getty over and she says in her accent, God rest her soul, she says, Getty, have you thanked Donna? And Getty just looks at me like eye roll, you know, it's like, Ma, every day, okay? Every day. But it's so typical, okay? I mean, Mom wanted to make sure that Getty expressed his gratitude even years later, but he always did. And people have said to me, well, do you think you'll be in the book? And I tell you something, and here again, I'm going to say what I said before. Let me be honest with you. I don't care if he never mentions me. I got a 48-year friendship out of this. He thanked me a multitude of times. There are numerous interviews where he gave credit to me. And you know what? That's fine. So if I'm not in his book, terrific. I don't care. I'm not the show. He's the show. He can write the book any way he wants to write it. If I occupy any part of it, God bless him. If I occupy no part of it, also God bless him. If he decides to trash me, which I don't think he would do because
Oh, I
that's not
doubt
the
that.
kind of person he is. But I'm saying, if he decided to do that, you know what? I'm philosophical about it all. As I said, I got a 48-year friendship out of this. How lucky am I?
Very lucky, and we lucked out as music fans. Donna, what are you working on right now? Do you have any projects in
Oh
the
my
work?
God, on which day? On which day?
Well, do you have any book projects, media projects that we might want to hear about
I
or
am working on three chapters for three different people's books. I just published an article for SABR, the Society for American Baseball Research, about another Negro Leagues team. I am working on a presentation about the first guy in Boston to do a sports talk show way back in the 1920s. I'm working on a bunch of other presentations. And of course, in June, I'm going to be inducted into the Mass Broadcasters Hall of Fame. And I'm really excited about that as well.
Yeah, by the time the show actually gets out there, you'll have already been in, probably been inducted or close to it. So again, congratulations. Where are you on the internet and where can the listeners find you?
Oh, they can just put me up on the Google, just Uncle Google. I do have a website, www.donnahalper.com. It's DonnaHalper.com. I am still on Twitter until the thing implodes at some point. I'm on Facebook. I'm on all kinds of places. I'm on Instagram, but not very often. So the best place to find me, probably Twitter or Facebook, or just reach out to me by email, for heaven's sake. I'm very happy to answer people's emails. DLH, which is my initials, at DonnaHalper.com, DLH at DonnaHalper.com. And there it is.
I'll put that in the show notes. Well, Donna, thank you very much for appearing on the show.
Oh, God, my pleasure. Why wouldn't I do it? Happy to do it.
Well, I've been wanting to do a Rush show since I started this show, and I kind of you popped up on Facebook when I'm like, wait a minute, that's it. That's my angle. I see if I can get Donna Halper on. She can talk about the first album, and we can just go from there. And it's been a great experience. And
Well, I
you
hope I
looked at
was halfway interesting.
Oh, you were more than interesting, trust me. And maybe we can do something else regarding Rush in the future, but I just want to say again, thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule. I know you've had a hell of a day. It's always great.
Happy to be just walking around. You know what?
That's
Cancer survivor,
right.
8 years.
That's right.
Every day
Congratulations.
is a blessing. Every day is so much better than the alternative. Even on my worst day, it's better than the alternative. I still teach full time. I still write. I still do public speaking. I still do volunteer work, et cetera, et cetera. Just trying to stay one step ahead of the hangman. So thank you very much for having me on.
My pleasure. And with that, we end this episode of Mr. K Super Show. We'll see you next time. Take care, everybody.
You've been listening to Mr. K Super Show. If you like what you heard, please write a review on Apple Podcasts and share it on Facebook, Twitter, or whatever social media you like. Thank you for listening to Mr. K Super Show.